Group meeting, Saturday, 27th July, 1985. No one in the world is ever completely free from conditioning, because every single human being, whoever he may be, is born inheriting the tendencies which have been the result of the immense evolutionary process, starting at least about 600 million years ago. The brain actually contains parts of it actually are the apparatus, so to say, of our reptilian and mammalian ancestry. And on top of that, there is the cortex, which is specifically human. And this cortex lives in uneasy truce, as the scientists say, with the mammalian and the reptilian part. So no one in the world is completely free of that. Even those whom we call the perfected holy ones, they too have to endure the consequence of this tremendous evolutionary process, because these parts of the brain are the physical apparatus through which the what we consider the unpleasant or the unvirtuous parts of our being manifest. They are the apparatus, the psychical, the mental, the spiritual atmosphere which in which we live, in addition to our physical atmosphere of air. That atmosphere contains the energies which need an apparatus for manifesting the unpleasant, the ill, the cruel, the horrible side of our human life. So no one escapes that conditioning. And the perfected holy ones, all of them, are perfect and holy insofar as their psyche is utterly pure. That is their perfection. But other aspects which are not quite up to that standard have to be contended with by them too. Also, there are other influences present always during the lifetime of the great teachers. The actual state of the accumulated knowledge of the times, that limits the expression of the truth which they had realized. All the scriptures of the world are expressions of that which is beyond all expression. The truth, so to say, is non-descript. There are no thoughts, there are no words which will describe that multidimensional reality. Thought and word depends upon our physical body as such, and particularly our brain and the control we have over knowledge, over speech. Because speech represents that which comes within our ken. And everything that comes within our ken in this finite and temporal world is itself finite and temporal. But through the purification of the psyche, pure mind that transcendent universal energy which is trying to function through us, is able to function freely only when the psyche is utterly purified. But it comes up against this problem of language and of thought. How can thought and word, which represents only that which is finite and temporal, be the medium of communication for the transcendent? It just cannot be so. So there is a limit to what human beings can ever realize for themselves, and there is also a limit to the extent to which they can communicate that which they have realized. The problem is the problem of communication. And the great ones, all of them, knew that problem. We have a delightful account in one of the Hindu scriptures in which the disciple asks the teacher to demonstrate the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality. And the teacher was silent. A second time, the disciple asked the same question. The teacher was silent. A third time, the disciple asked the same question. And the teacher said, "I am demonstrating the ultimate truth, which it is possible for me to demonstrate, but you are unable to receive it and respond to it." Now you see the tremendous significance of that. Silence is the language of the infinite eternal. I have to use the word silence because it is the word which describes our physical state and physical limitation. Silence in the physical sense is the language of transcendence. What consciousness can realize through living the religious life and arriving at that state where you wake up to the infinite and the eternal is something which ordinary thought and speech, the brain and the tongue, and our knowledge of language cannot possibly express. So we must always bear that in mind, which leaves room for complete tolerance of what already exists, and also for tolerance with regard to some of the mistaken statements of the greatest of the teachers. It's a common mistake by all devotees. The very devoted type thinks of his or her teacher as omniscient in the absolute sense. There is no such thing as omniscience for any human being alive in the absolute sense. It isn't possible. There is always growth, there is always progress. The universe, the whole cosmos, is not a static entity. It is a growing, living entity as such. So we have to bear that in mind and consider the whole of our life experience and all that we achieve or attain with a completely open mind, and all that we receive from anybody and everybody, receive it with a completely open mind. You may remember how many hundred times during these 24 years I have said, "Don't believe a word I say." Because mere belief is impotent. If the words I use happen to represent in some degree or other, however small or however great as the case may be, something which so inspires you that you, in your inner consciousness, wake up to that which seems to you truth in the real sense, well and good. That is so. But then it is you who have woken up to it. I haven't taught you, but you have learned. See, that is why I always disclaim being called a teacher. I'm not a teacher. I'm your servant, that's all. I try to put things before people to whom I speak in such a manner that they find themselves inspired by it. And in that, through that inspiration, they awaken to an inner truth. And if it is a real inner truth, they themselves will never be able to put it into words. You see what I mean? So now we have always to bear that in mind. And I mention this particularly now because, as we all know, throughout history, some of the worst wars and cruelties have taken place in the name of religion, in the name of divine truth and all that sort of stuff. You see? So if we understand this, we can be free from ourselves generating energies or producing causes for hatred between man and man. You see, it is a well-known fact all over the world that the narrow devotees of all religions say that yes, other religions have done some good, but ours is the perfect one, the perfect thing. Ours is the last word, the truth. There is no such thing as finality in the context of the infinite and the eternal. If there were something like finality in the context of the infinite and the eternal, there could be no growth, no progress made here in that which is finite and temporal. You see? So we must understand these things. We have to start with the intellectual understanding. Once the intellectual understanding is there, and the open-mindedness is there, which allows room for that intellectual understanding to grow and grow and grow and grow forever and ever, so to say, as long as we live. If we have that intellectual understanding, then our consciousness can wake up to the infinite eternal. This, I have sometimes used the phrase, the lightning of transcendence strikes you. Now, whereas material lightning, I think I'm justified in saying material lightning because it is electricity, it is something which we know of, and so forth. When material lightning strikes us, well, then that is the finish of everything. We have everlasting peace as far as we ourselves are concerned. But if the lightning of transcendence strikes you, your innermost consciousness wakens up to this. And it so affects the whole of the psyche, which means the intellectual, emotional part of our being, that our whole life is thereby changed. And it is changed in the right direction, in the direction of profounder truth, of goodness, of beauty, and peace of mind. Now, this is of fundamental importance to all of us, especially to people like ourselves who form groups like this and meet together. If we seek a final statement, a final truth, a final expression of truth, then we are mistaken. There is no end to it. Consider how the body lives, for instance. from the moment we are born, helped by a loving little thwack from the midwife, when we make our first speech on our arrival in the world, from that moment till the time we die, till the moment we die, we breathe. Constantly breathe. You see? And what do we call it? We call it the life breath. And the rhythm of that breath is the life rhythm, isn't it? Now, similarly, where the realization of truth is concerned, one grows and grows, one wakes up and wakes up, waking up in profounder and profounder degrees, in profounder intensities of waking up. But there is no end to it. When the body dies, it dies. But the realization of truth has no beginning, it has no death. So when we talk about the holy ones being the perfected holy ones, I think it is helpful to bear this sort of thing in mind. Now, this freedom from conditioning is preeminently marked by the fact that each savior or enlightened one outgrew the tradition in which he was brought up and the disciplines in which he was trained, without seeking to deliberately oust or destroy the faith and religious practice of his own fellow men. You remember how Jesus said, "I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill." Those are his words. And yet, Jesus himself, "No one cometh unto the Father but through me." And he said to his disciples, "Go ye forth and preach to all the nations." Well, the word goi has been, Hebrew goi has been translated as nations, which I think is a mistake. The goi was the particular group which was interested in human fulfillment in the true sense, the religious sense. And there must have been groups. For instance, we know that there were the famous Essenes in his day and so forth. There were teachers like Philo Judaeus and Gamaliel and several others who had their own following, you see. And Jesus meant really go and speak unto them and teach them. But because it has been translated as nations, we have this unhappy phenomenon. We have had it for centuries throughout history of militant evangelism. We've got the truth. You've got to take to it, or else you'll know all about it. You see the absurdity of that situation. We are supposed to be Homo sapiens. I don't see any sapience in that attitude. There's extraordinary folly and, unfortunately, a very cruel folly, as history has shown. Now, the teacher's teaching, nevertheless, inevitably shakes, even cracks, a fossilized old order. Every teacher ushers in a new order in some degree or other. Whereas the founders of the great religions, as far as I'm aware, practically all of them, with the exception of Muhammad, made their special contribution in the strictly religious field, the mystical field, with the implied metaphysics which underlay that mysticism. Although the Buddhists, for instance, will say, "Oh no, we have nothing to do with metaphysics. We are only concerned with living the pure life, the good life, and so forth." That's all very true. But the ideas which are being put into practice, not only in Buddhism, but in every other religion, are ideas which have an implied underlying metaphysical basis. You can't get away from that. Otherwise, the whole the whole subject of the philosophy of religion would never have emerged at all, would never have come into being. See, there is an underlying metaphysics. But in the case of Muhammad, the changes that he brought about were not metaphysical at all. They were social. They were social changes. What shall a man do when his wife wants a divorce, or he wants a divorce from the wife and so forth? According to the customs of the day, things were of course very difficult. But it was Muhammad who introduced the idea. No question about who is the guilty party. If three times, that is not at the same, on the same occasion, but on three separate occasions, separated by several months, in order to allow for possible reconciliation and possible understanding, you see, if each of them said, I divorce you, then that divorce, in the presence of relatives and friends, was finalized. Now, whoever was the guilty party, and there was, of course, sometimes what we call guilt involved in it, the man always had to support the woman and all the children by her. So, whilst those who were sheikhs, there weren't any oil sheikhs in those days, but there were sheikhs, you see, those who were sheikhs and could afford it had more than one wife. Muhammad laid down four. He himself had four wives and he had nine concubines altogether, if I remember right. Or nine wives in all, or something like that. But he himself couldn't break away entirely from the practice of the day. It just so shows how we must be very sensitive to the fact that human beings suffer from all kinds of limitations. Therefore, there must only be compassion for them. So, the teaching of the teacher does shake an old fossilized order. The living truth is not a doctrine or belief or mental cognition or intuitive perception or verbal statement. It is the unself-conscious, immediate awareness of the here now. You see, to give us a simple example of what this implies in terms of everyday life. Supposing we go out for a little constitutional in the park every morning or evening or whatever it is. And we pass by what we call the same trees, the same flower beds. And what do in our own minds, in the brain? The brain says, oh, there's the old oak, you see, or there's the lovely clump of rose bushes and so forth. But it is the old one, we say. Now, you see, when we do that, we are not really looking. We are just projecting our image of that oak tree or that flower garden or whatever it is, you see. We are just projecting that image upon the actual oak tree or the flower garden as we pass by. The fact of the whole cosmical process is that every single thing continuously changes. I, the subject who am looking, am changing all the time. That oak tree or that flower bed is changing all the time. So, I, a changed being, am looking at a changed object all the time. But you see, this silly old brain says, oh, there's the old oak. It isn't the old oak. It's a totally new oak. Something completely different from what it was before. And I who am looking, am also completely changed. Now, if I can look transcendentally, without sort of projecting my fossilized image of the oak tree upon the actual oak tree as such, if I can look like that, you know, you have to try and practice this, and you will find that what I'm saying is quite true. If you can look at it afresh, completely afresh, you will feel an extraordinary at-one-ment with what you are looking, and at-one-ment which is transcendental love in manifestation. You're in union with the thing. A union which is devoid of possessiveness, of concupiscence, or desire, approval or disapproval, etc. Now you see, that is the main reason why I have said again and again, our senses are really the cords of communion. And in that experiencing, in the immediate moment of that communion, the truth is revealed to you. You are conscious of the truth of that tree, the truth of that flower garden. Now this, of course, applies extremely strongly in terms of human relationships. How do we look upon our brother or sister or wife or husband or father or mother? We look at each person in terms of the image we have formed in our own brain of that person. Now this is where the trouble comes. If we can develop this, allow this faculty of looking, listening, hearing, smelling, tasting, absolutely afresh every time, transcendentally therefore, then our whole life would be completely transformed. We will be utterly free of fear, for one thing. We will be, you know how when somebody close to oneself, be he friend or a relative or whoever it is, gets into a certain mood or says something, we immediately interpret that in terms of our image, our old image. Oh, yes, yes. That's what he is like, grumpy old fellow, you see. Well, all right, he is a grumpy old fellow. But if I can look at him absolutely afresh, that grumpiness gets transformed in my consciousness into something totally different. You'll say it's an almost superhuman feat. I say it is a purely human feat. What we do is, all that we do is subhuman. We are not yet at that stage. But that is something which we can grow towards. And if we do grow towards it, we will realize that we are our brother's keepers. Every one of us. Now many people, they have said this to me, so I know. Well, it's all very well for you to talk like that, and so, but if you were in my situation, etc., etc. But how do you know that I have not been in your situation to start with? Have you ever tried and kept on trying? It is by keeping on trying that finally the good result comes. Otherwise it doesn't. It's so difficult, it's so airy-fairy and all this. Yes, but truth is utterly airy-fairy. If any one of us talks about the context of the infinite and the eternal and of transcendence and all that sort of thing to the average hard-headed, sensible man of this man in the street, he will think, oh, this fellow's a little bit nutty. Only. So there we are. So we have to go on. If we are really concerned with living the religious life, which means living the pure human life, then we have to just keep on trying. And be nutty in that sense. Because this nuttiness is the transcendental nut, which is the nut that is the most nourishing nut that there ever was. So now, the holiness of the mind depends on spiritual insight, and insight depends on purity of mind and heart. I've used the word mind here rather than the word psyche. The word psyche would be more correct, because in the book later on, you see, it took 21 years to produce this book. 21 years. From 1954 till 1975. In a later chapter, I show how what we commonly call mind really is what should be called psyche. Mind is this universal, transcendent mode of manifestation of the creative energy, which is a formative power, which is associated with pure consciousness, all knowingness, all awareness. You see? That is mind. But it being a universal energy, coming, interacting with the body, the material body, it gives rise to mental phenomena. It is rooted, that energy is rooted in the brain and the nervous system. And it is influenced, as far as its expression goes, by the activity of the ductus glands and our inheritance over several hundred million years in our brain through the reptiles and the mammals and so on. You see. So we have psyche. We can legitimately say my psyche, but we all say my mind. There is no such thing as my mind. You might as well say my space. Does anybody possess any space? Can you cut out a bit of space and say that this is my space? You can't. It's like that. These archetypal expressions of the transcendent, primordial creative energy are beyond all limitation, beyond all description. But they function, they work. If they weren't there, there wouldn't be that perpetual persuasive power which makes the cosmos come to its fruition. That is how the cosmos comes to its fruition and all that is contained in it. It never compels infinite power. Never compels, it has no need to. It just is, and by virtue of its presence, slowly, 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 it allows the imperfect to grow into perfection. That is how it happens. This is one of the profound meanings of the theistical expression, the love of God for His creation. This is love, this infinite patience, this infinite forbearance, and so on. In the Dhammapada, for instance, you will find, I forget the exact chapter, but it's somewhere in the middle, where the Buddha's words are quoted, that of the importance of patience and forbearance. And then it proceeds to Nirvana is supreme. And Nirvana literally means the complete transmutation of all greed, hate, and delusion. That's what Nirvana means. The first and fundamental meaning. So now, our inquiring and experimenting and searching for truth is simply our love gift to life abundant. The fact that we inquire and search for it must be regarded as our gift through pure love, expecting nothing, hoping nothing, wanting nothing at all, unreservedly, unconditionally, give oneself totally and completely to the transcendent reality, the one total reality. And we can't do that. The Catholics are so right in saying we are born in sin. What is our sin? Our isolative, separative self-consciousness. I am I, not you. I am the self, not the rest of the universe, the not-self. And that is the fundamental root of all conflict, hate, misery, and all the rest of it. Many a high-sounding motive may lure the unwary writer to expound the true meaning of Holy Scripture, to comfort the sorrowing, to enlighten those in darkness, to serve God, to love one's neighbor, to save man from destruction, to exalt the true faith, to leave the world a better place than one found it, to show the underlying reality of the world's religions, and so on. We must beware of all these allurements as motives. If we have motives to save somebody else's soul, we shall be damning ourselves and somebody else at the same time. Let be. Everything will happen in its own natural way, ultimately. This is extremely difficult. Can we not see that all these motives are rooted in selfness, delusion, pride, conceit, ignorance, hate, power lust, and greed? They are all modes of exploitation of man by man. And yet, if a writer writes or a speaker speaks, because carefree, thoughtless not in the meaning of being inconsiderate or anything like that, but there's no thought behind it to go out and save the other person or help the other person and so on. If carefree love carries him on the crest of a creative life wave, might not all pure motives find sweet and unpremeditated fulfillment? Look how this particularly applies in our relationships with our children. Millions and millions of parents throughout the ages have, in the name of love, for the sake of the good of the children, tried to bend the child's growth in the rather darkened light of one's own conceptions of what the child ought to be. And you see, that is a relationship which is not a relationship of love. I have to be like a gardener with my children. Sylvia and I were rather lucky with our children. We just allowed them to grow. Partly because neither of us knew what to do. And they just growed up like Topsy. You see? But this sort of compelling the child to do this, to achieve that, to become this, and etc., etc., is the thing that spoils the child's life, really. Sometimes it doesn't, because inherent in that particular child are already the seeds which will come to flower in the way that the parents have seen. But that is rather rare. You know, we all know that each generation is again the previous generation, isn't it? It's common knowledge all over the world. Why is that? I was rather fortunate with my parents. I was never again them. I was with them all along the line. And they were with me all along the line, particularly my father, who just let me go the way I wanted to go. He advised, and if I went against his advice and something went wrong, all he did was say, "It's all right, sonny, now let's put it right together. Let's put it right together." He was like that. I was exceptionally fortunate. In him, I experienced the truth of that statement, and underneath are the everlasting arms. He didn't know that he was doing all this. It was his natural nature, so to say, to be like that. Now, let's go on. The reader and the writer must approach the heart of religion like beggars, stripped, dispossessed. Our greatest qualification when we approach the unknown is that we know nothing. We mustn't presume to know that unknown. The transcendent is not only the unknown, but is the unknowable. That is to say, unknowable in our ordinary meaning of the word knowing. Our ordinary meaning of the word knowing is the synthesizing by the brain of all the sense impressions that we receive and all the experiences that we go through. That knowing belongs completely and is confined entirely to the finite and temporal sphere. That is not the transcendent reality. That is not our reality also, even individually concerned. So, we must approach truth, the discovery of truth, with the mind completely empty. I should say the psyche. The psyche must be completely empty. Let the truth reveal itself. You know, for instance, I don't know why this suddenly comes into my mind. When a marriage takes place, most people marry their particular picture of marriage. A man has a particular conception of the girl who ought to be this, that and the other, and he meets somebody who in some respect or other slightly fits into that picture, and he falls head over heels, as he says, in love. He's not in love, he's in folly. I experienced folly in my young days. And the young ladies just went off like birds. I made a picture, and the picture was humbug. I just plastered it onto this one and that one, and it was wrong. You see, one has to beware of all these things, but it's not easy. So, we must approach with the psyche entirely empty. The attention is blind, waiting to be shown. It is deaf, waiting the word. It is bisexed and unprocreative, waiting the immaculate conception and virgin birth. It is lame, waiting the leading of the divine hand. In this clean state of primordial newness, we may beg for our daily bread in all seriousness. How do we beg for our daily bread? You know that the Lord's Prayer of Christendom is a very wonderful thing, but is it really understood? Do people really know what it means, actually? The Sermon on the Mount, things like, blessed are the meek, blessed are the poor, etc. What does it really mean? Christendom as a whole just doesn't know the meaning. It's the same with all the other religions too, all the organized religions. Now, the holy books of the world, which state the word of God or truth or wisdom or love, will remain stumbling monuments, painfully bruising us, unless we read them with the eye and the heart. Unless we read them as the wordless holy book, the book of life, in which indeed day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. He who reads the book of life understands. Out of his understanding arise the verbal forms which express his comprehension, that is, at our level of the finite and temporal. His word of wisdom is his compassionate response to his children hungry for truth. Let the child learn of his father. As the theist may say, God shines his face upon his son. And are not reader and writer his sons? Mind, like a sensitive plate, suffers the imprint. But alas, ignorance mistakes the picture for the living beloved, and lust and hate exploit the mistake. Man is born free, but the organized religions, together with the sanctions of heaven and hell to support them, twist his mind into the tortuous mold of congealed thought.